Okay, so get this, right? Imagine a world, no batteries, none. Like no phones,
Oh
no
man.
laptops,
Yeah.
no electric
Or
cars.
even more critical, right? Like imagine your blood pH just going completely haywire.
Oh, talk about a system crash, right?
Yeah.
And the chemistry we're diving into today, like it underpins all of that and a bunch more. Like we're going deep into pH, acids, bases, all that stuff, the essentials of aqueous solutions.
Absolutely. And we're taking a look at excerpts from your chemistry textbook, focusing on those really important chapters on acid-base reactions, redox reactions, and all the energy that it takes to make and break those chemical bonds.
And it's pretty wild, right? Because even if you think back to like high school chemistry, like, oh yeah, H2O, that's simple, right? Like even plain old water, way more dynamic than we give you credit for.
It really is. Yeah, those water molecules are constantly exchanging protons, those H plus ions, and they're forming hydronium, H3O plus, and
Yeah.
hydroxide, OH ions in the process.
So it's not just like a static bunch of H2O molecules just hanging out.
Not at all. It's way more dynamic than that. You can almost think about it like a constantly shifting dance. And that dance, my friend, that's what determines pH.
Okay.
A high concentration of those hydronium ions means you have a low pH, which we call acidic. But if we have a lot of hydroxide ions, that means a high pH or
It's like
basic.
a chemical teeter-totter, trying to
Exactly.
find that balance, right?
Exactly.
So something like lemon juice, right? Like we all know, lemon juice, sour, acidic, it must have a higher concentration of those hydronium ions, right?
Yeah, you got it. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have baking soda, which, you use to neutralize acid. So it's got to be packed with those hydroxide ions ready to counteract that acidity.
Which makes you think, right, we're talking about a spectrum here. Is the pH scale really as simple as 1 to 14? Like what they showed us on those like classroom posters back in the day.
It's a great question, and it turns out not so much. Our textbook actually mentions some seriously strong acids out there, acids that can even have a pH below one.
Below one. That's intense.
Yeah.
It's like it makes you realize how extreme the chemistry world can get, even though we only, experience a small slice of it.
It really highlights how finely tuned things need to be, especially in biological systems like our own bodies, right? Our blood has to stay right around a pH of 7.4. Even a small shift can be super dangerous, even fatal.
Which brings us to, well, we're talking about acids, we're talking about bases, something I always remember being a little bit fuzzy on, buffers. What's their deal again, and why are they so important?
Okay, so let's think about it this way. Our textbook gives us this really great comparison. Strong acids like hydrochloric acid, which is actually the stuff in our stomachs,
Oh, wow.
completely ionizes in water. It basically breaks apart entirely into ions.
Okay, so full breakdown, got it.
Right. But then you have these weaker acids like acetic acid, which is essentially just vinegar, and that only partially ionizes.
So how does that play into, like, I guess the difference between, the acid in our stomach versus the acid in vinegar? Why is one so much harsher than the other?
So that difference in ionization, basically how much those acid molecules break apart, that's the key to understanding why some acids are stronger than others. More ions floating around, the more acidic that solution is going to be.
So it's about the concentration of those ions, not just the type of acid itself.
Precisely. And our source material had this really interesting little tidbit. At any given time, a single acetic acid molecule is only ionized about 1.6% of the time.
Wow.
It's the overall concentration of those ions in the entire solution that really dictates the pH.
So it's not like every single molecule is always ionized. It's more about the average across the board.
Exactly,
Okay.
exactly. It's this delicate balance. And that brings us to why buffers are so crucial. Imagine if our blood pH just swung wildly every time we ate something acidic or something basic.
Oh man. Chaos.
Right. Our poor bodies wouldn't stand a chance.
Yeah.
Buffers help resist those changes, acting like almost like our internal antacids, always working to keep things stable.
Our chemical peacekeepers,
Exactly.
keeping those pH levels in check.
You got.
So buffers, they're like our chemical peacekeepers, right? Keeping those pH levels in check. That's pretty impressive stuff.
It is. But let's shift gears a little bit here and talk about something that's equally important in the world of aqueous solutions, and that's electrons on the move with redox reactions.
Okay, redox reactions. Now, this is where things might start sounding a little bit more like, high school chemistry class, right?
Yeah.
But like before your eyes glaze over, think about rust.
Oh, yeah.
Rust is That's a redox reaction in action.
It is a fantastic example, and it's something that we see all the time. But how often do we really stop and think, hey, wait a minute, there's some serious electron exchange happening right there on that old bike?
Exactly. So for those who maybe need a bit of a refresher, what's actually going on in a redox reaction?
Well, at its absolute core, it's all about the transfer of electrons from one atom or molecule to another. Oxidation is when an atom loses electrons, and reduction is when an atom gains those electrons.
Okay, so it's like this chemical tug of war over those electrons.
Yes, and like any good tug of war, you know it's always a two-way process. Oxidation and reduction, they always go hand in hand.
So in the case of rust, like iron is losing electrons to oxygen, meaning that the iron is being oxidized, and oxygen, because it's gaining those electrons, it's being reduced.
You've got it. And, you know, our textbook uses this really, really clear example to illustrate this. The formation of something that we use literally every single day. Table salt, NaCl.
Wait, really? Table salt comes from a redox reaction.
Absolutely. Sodium is a highly reactive metal. It really, really wants to lose an electron. And then you've got chlorine, which is this highly reactive gas, and it really, really wants to gain an electron. So they are a match made in heaven, right? Sodium gets oxidized, chlorine gets reduced, and voila, we have table salt.
Who knew there was so much drama happening in our salt shaker?
Right. But it turns out that electron transfer isn't always as straightforward as this, like, clean handoff, right? Our textbook points out that even reactions where it's not as obvious, like the formation of water from hydrogen and oxygen gas, are still considered redox reactions, even though it might not seem like it at first glance.
Hold on. So how does that work? Because I thought we were talking about electrons being fully transferred, right? Water is just hydrogen and oxygen sharing electrons.
Right. So that's where it gets really interesting. It's not always about those electrons making a clean break and completely switching sides like a soccer trade or something. Sometimes they just end up hanging out closer to one atom within that bond. It's like when oxygen hogs those electrons in a water molecule.
Because oxygen is more electronegative, right?
Right.
It has a stronger pull on those electrons.
Exactly. So even though those electrons in that water molecule, they're being shared between the hydrogen and the oxygen, they're not being shared equally. They're spending more of their time buzzing around that oxygen atom.
Okay, so it's really about electron density, like where those electrons are most likely to be found.
Precisely. And because of that uneven sharing, that's why we still consider oxygen to be reduced, and we still consider hydrogen to be oxidized in the formation of water, even though it's not like a complete transfer. It's this more subtle shift in the electron density than, say, the sodium chloride example we talked about earlier.
Okay, so it's almost like a spectrum of electron behavior. I like that. But why should we even care about these, like, subtle electron shifts? How does this actually affect us in the real world?
That's a great question. And the answer is, it's actually pretty profound. These redox reactions are happening all the time in ways that we just don't even realize, and they're essential for life itself.
Oh, wow. Really? Tell me more.
Yeah, so think about it. We breathe in oxygen, right? And we, quote unquote, burn food for energy.
Right.
Those processes, as fundamental as they are to our existence, are driven by this incredibly complex series of redox reactions happening constantly within our cells.
So all that electron shuffling is literally keeping us alive.
Yeah, it really is. It's incredible. And this brings us to another really crucial aspect of chemistry that our textbook kind of dives into here, and that's energy changes during reactions.
Yeah, because all those moving electrons, all those bonds forming and breaking, all of that has to involve some sort of energy transfer, right?
Yeah.
So we've covered pGotch, acids, bases, those like electron swapping redox reactions.
Yeah.
But like, where does energy actually fit into all of this? Our textbook talks about something called enthalpy, right?
Right. Enthalpy, which we represent with the symbol H, is essentially a measure of how much heat is released or absorbed during a chemical reaction. It's like almost like a reaction's energy budget.
Okay.
You know?
So like when we burn fuel, right, that releases a lot of heat. I'm guessing that's got like a pretty big enthalpy change.
Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. So that's what we call an exothermic reaction. It releases heat into the surroundings, and its enthalpy change, or that H, is going to have a negative value. And then on the flip side, you have endothermic reactions, which actually absorb heat from their surroundings. It's kind of like they're sucking energy in, and they have a positive H.
Okay, so exothermic, release heat, think, like a roaring fire. Endothermic absorbs it, like, I don't know, like those, like, instant ice packs that you crack to make them cold.
Exactly.
But yeah. Where does all that energy actually come from or go to.
That's where those chemical bonds come into play. Remember how we were just talking about bonds forming and breaking?
Yeah, like that whole chemical tug of war with the electrons.
Exactly. And so our textbook used this great example of methane combustion, which is essentially how we get energy from natural gas. Methane, which is CH4, reacts with oxygen to produce carbon dioxide, water, and a whole lot of heat.
And that heat comes from the bonds themselves.
Exactly. The energy stored within those bonds is what gets released or absorbed during a reaction. So in the case of methane combustion, the energy that's released when those super strong carbon-oxygen double bonds form in CO2, that's much greater than the energy that's required to break the initial bonds in the methane and the oxygen. And that surplus, that difference, that's what we feel is heat.
Oh, okay, so that's why it feels hot. There's literally more energy being released than it took to, like, get things going in the first place.
Precisely. It's like that old saying, right? You gotta spend money to make money. Sometimes you need a little bit of energy input to break those initial bonds, but the payoff can be huge when stronger bonds form and they release even more energy back into the surroundings.
I like that. That makes sense. Mm. And our textbook also mentioned that these bond energies, they're usually measured in a lab, like specifically in the gas phase. But like in the real world, most reactions aren't happening with molecules just like floating around freely. They're usually in a solution of some sort.
You're hitting on a really, really important point. And that is that in solution, things get, well, a bit more complex. You have all these other molecules interacting and influencing each other. These intermolecular forces, the attractions and repulsions between those molecules, can actually impact how much energy a reaction needs or releases.
So for those of us who haven't taken chemistry in a while, intermolecular forces, those are kind of like, what, molecular peer pressure. They can kind of like nudge those reactions in one direction or another.
I love that, yeah. That's a fantastic way to put it. So while those bond energies that are measured in the gas phase, they give us like a good starting point. You know, real world chemistry is often a lot messier and frankly, a lot more fascinating than a pristine lab setup.
Yeah, I guess that's what makes it exciting. So how does all this energy talk apply to us, to our everyday lives?
Well, for one thing, it helps us to understand why some fuels burn hotter than others. And it also explains why our bodies generate heat. We're basically like walking, talking combustion engines. Think about it. Our bodies are constantly carrying out these complex chemical reactions, many of which are exothermic. And all those reactions, all that electron shuffling, all that bond rearranging, it adds up. That's why we have a body temperature.
Wow, so we're literally powered by chemistry.
We really are.
That's amazing. But speaking of like reactions and energy, right, we've talked a lot about CO2. Which we all know was a big player in climate change. And our textbook actually had a really like interesting point about its stability.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's so fascinating from a purely chemical perspective. But then, you know, it's also a bit concerning when we think about the long-term environmental implications. Remember those crazy strong carbon-oxygen double bonds in CA2 that release all that energy when they form?
Yeah, like during the methane combustion, that's what makes it such a good fuel source.
Exactly, but that also means that CO2 is very, very content in its current state, you know? Those strong bonds make it incredibly stable, and that's also why it's so challenging to break those bonds and convert CO2 into something that's, well, less harmful to the atmosphere.
So it's almost like CO2 is stuck in this like low energy rut and it takes a lot of effort to kind of coax it out.
Yeah, that's a really great way to think about it. And it really highlights the immense challenge and honestly, the urgent need to find innovative new ways to deal with CO2. You know, if it's this stable because of those strong bonds, maybe we need to get creative about how we can either break those bonds or maybe even capture that CO2 before it had a chance to form in the first place.
Yeah, it's definitely it's daunting, but it's also really like exciting to think about all the possibilities.
It really is.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for, you know, taking this deep dive with us into the world of aqueous solutions. We've covered so much ground today, you know, from the surprisingly dynamic nature of water all the way to those powerful bonds that hold everything together.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
It really has. And to our listeners, we hope this deep dive has given you a fresh perspective on the chemistry that's happening literally all around us, in our bodies, in our environment, even in our kitchens.
Absolutely.
It really is this hidden world full of wonder, and we hope you're inspired to keep exploring. So until next time, keep those reactions balanced and those energy levels high.